Good morning, Council, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 6, 2024, and we are ready for the second case on our three-case oral argument calendar. A couple of housekeeping matters while you get settled in and take your time. The podium can be raised or lowered with a switch that's found at the front of it, so please feel free to adjust that to your comfort. The proceedings are being recorded. They're being live streamed on Zoom, and there's an audio recording that will be available on our website within about 24 hours of the argument. That's the only recording of these proceedings. There's no other recording that should be made. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent, you'll have 15 minutes. When you start your argument, please start by identifying yourself for the record and who you represent, and let us know if you want us to refer to you in any particular way. With that, we will proceed to the second case on our calendar. That's A230995, Daniela Tate, petitioner, respondent, versus Daniel Lee Tate, appellant. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Can I ask what you said just before you said, let us know, because I didn't hear that.
Oh, that's okay. I just said, if you have a different way of, I'm presuming you're Mr. White.
That is correct.
So if you would prefer to be referred to in a different way than Mr. White when we ask you questions, just let us know.
That's fine, Your Honor. You can refer to me as Mr. White or Master Sergeant White. It doesn't matter to me.
All right. Thank you, sir.
I've done this before. May it please the court. My name is Master Sergeant Francis Herbert White III, U.S. Air Force retired, here on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant First Class Daniel Tate, U.S. Army retired. I'm here on a matter asking the court to take a look at three things that were done in the District Court of Washington County. The first of those things is the assignment and the designation of permanent spousal maintenance. The second is the imputation of income on behalf of the respondent. And the third thing is the redivision of property that took place after the matter came before the district court on a motion to amend. I'm going to start with the last thing, if it pleases the court. Last year, this court had to redirect district court judges who exceeded their authority two times on matters of parenting consultants. District courts sometimes exceed their authority, and the Washington County District Court exceeded its authority when it set a binding arbitrator, decided that binding arbitration would be used in order to resolve any disputes. In doing so, he exceeded his authority, the district court judge, but that was remedied. That was remedied because both parties agreed that the district court didn't have the authority to set binding arbitration. That could only be done by agreement of the parties. But in doing so, the district court proceeded to redivide property that had already been divided and property for which the respondent had already identified that she wanted, in compliance with the judgment and decree issued by the court on July 28th of 2022.
Did the parties notify the district court of any agreement regarding the distribution, the distribution of the assets?
The parties did not, Your Honor. The respondent, the petitioner in the lower court, did. If I direct the court's attention to DOC ID number 62, on August 17th, the respondent, submitted to the court in per the instructions of the district court and submitted to me via email a letter stating the items that she wanted. She did that within the 20 days that the district court had told her that she had to do that. She sent me that letter, and she submitted this document to the court. She also stated in the letter that she would accept the method of shipping through the U.S. Army that the petitioner, the respondent in the lower proceeding, had proposed that the items would be shipped free of cost by the U.S. Army as a result of his permanent change of station and his retirement from the Army. This document is in the record and was in the record. Nobody, not the petitioner, not the respondent, asked the district court to redivide the property.
I understand the last point, but a husband did bring a motion to amend the findings under Rule 5202. And if a party raises that issue with the district court has fairly broad authority to amend the findings in any way, even beyond what is requested by any one party.
That may be true, Your Honor. But the scope of the ask, which was not conceded, which was not opposed by the respondent petitioner down below, was simply to get rid of the arbitration. And the respondent petitioner down below had already complied with the court's order. There was no need for the court to redivide the property. And it is inequitable because that division of property resulted in an inequitable outcome on behalf of Sergeant First Class Tate, because the property settlement that was created in the judgment and decree took into account the division of the significant amount of debt the parties had.
So what would happen had, under the original order, the respondent had just said, I want everything in the storage space, and she would have gotten 100, would she have been able to get 100% under that scenario?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Well, because then my client would have objected to that, and the district court would have had to make a decision on how that property was to be divided.
But the original order basically gave the respondent free rein to go into the storage space, right, and pick out what she wanted. Do I have that right?
No, Your Honor.
What was the limitation on it?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, go ahead.
The limitation on it was that the respondent, petitioner down below, had to designate the items that she wanted. And she did so. She did so within the 20 days, on the 20-day mark exactly, and she filed that not only with me, but she filed it with the court. It's MnSys Doc ID 62. That portion of the order had been complied with.
What was the limitation on what she could pick out? I mean, was
what
there...
she designated?
So why couldn't she have gone in and designated everything?
But she didn't.
So my point is, though, if she had done that the first time, right, and then your client had objected, then the court would have had to, under 518-58, would have had to do that analysis you're talking about, make a just and equitable division of marital property, and determine if what respondent was doing was unjust. So I think the point Judge Reyes is asking about is, once your client makes a motion to modify, the court still has the same obligation. What's just and equitable? So it would seem to me your stronger argument would be what the court did wasn't procedurally improper because the court couldn't do it, but rather it resulted in an unjust and inequitable division of property. So can you tell me
that is absolutely a very, very poignant analysis, Your Honor. But I always start with the defect in the procedure. And maybe I should have started otherwise. It resulted in an inequitable distribution, a distribution that had, from the respondent petitioner down below's perspective, already acted in order to do that. The problem was her parents couldn't do that, and the parties had come to a resolution of that. Although it's not in the record, those items are now in the state of Minnesota and can be distributed to the respondent, petitioner down below, based on her statement that she would accept the U.S. Army shipping those things to the United States. Those items are available for her.
So the district court amended its order to say, okay, sell the assets and have a 50-50 division, correct?
If the parties couldn't come to an agreement.
Okay, but that's what the district court said is basically, you know, just 50-50.
Yes.
I don't care if she asked for one item. I don't care if she asked for all the items. It's going to be a 50-50 split. So how is that inequitable? Because it's well known that it's not inequitable to have, you don't have to have equal distribution necessarily for it to be equitable. But in this case, the district court actually did say, it's 50-50.
In the event that the parties could not agree, and the parties have in fact agreed, and they agreed before that hearing, the intent and purpose of that was to address the fact that the district court had exceeded its authority in assigning a binding arbitrator, much as the district courts had exceeded their authority in appointing parenting consultants, and this court properly smacked them down.
So did the district court actually have language in there saying if the parties don't agree, then it will be 50-50? So did the district court actually qualify that language in the amended order?
I assume you have the order in front of you, Your Honor.
I'm trying to find that.
I can read it for you.
If that's the case, assuming that's true, then if the parties agree, does that control?
The parties have 20 days from the date of entry of this order to determine how to divide the property currently in storage in Germany. If the parties had failed to reach an agreement by that date, all the items in storage shall be sold and proceeds shall be divided 50-50. If there are currently items in storage that were specifically awarded to respondent, he may remove them before the sale of the remaining property. He must provide petitioner with a list of the property he sold. The parties had agreed prior to the entry of this order what property would be hers.
So can you just explain to me how this is harmful to your client? If there's already been an agreement on how to divide the property, how is this change harmful to your client?
If the respondent, the petitioner down below, chooses to go beyond the scope of what she identified as the property she wanted, it's harmful to him because then it ends up in a receipt on her part of 50% of the proceeds from the sale of the marital property.
But aren't you saying that item 62, she already indicated what items she would like, which would indicate that the parties have already come to an agreement in terms of how they're going to divide this property, so we're not even going to trigger this 50-50 division? It's just not clear to me how this harms your client if there's already been an agreement with regards to how this property is going to get divided.
My position is that it already is an agreement. That is a position. And if this agreement is followed, Your Honor, then the 50-50 would not get triggered. The problem, of course, is that the 50-50 that's in there has a perspective for harm for my client should the marital property have to be sold and then the proceeds divided. I see I'm running low on time.
I have one more question, which
yes,
is, are you aware of the McCauley decision from the Supreme Court in 1977, which does seem to indicate that once a Rule 52 motion is filed, the district court can relook at their whole order? And if so, can you tell us how you would distinguish that case?
Yes, Your Honor. I would distinguish that case simply from the facts of this case. In this case, the agreement had already taken place. The parties, namely the respondent, the petitioner down below, had already complied with the court's initial order, which was to identify the property that would be collected that she designated to be her own. And the court was aware of that because it was in the record at the time. So factually, this is distinct because the facts of the of this matter is she had already complied.
Had already complied with the previous order. So an amendment to the order doesn't make sense in the context of the that subdivision had already been fulfilled.
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly. And that's why it's different. Okay. Yes, I'm running low on time, Your Honors. As far as the spousal maintenance is concerned, when Judge Gower recalculated the spousal maintenance, one of the things that he did not do was he did not take into account and I'm talking about in his amended order, he did not take into account my client's actual and reported expenses because my client did file a parenting financial disclosure statement. And that parenting financial disclosure statement, which is in the record, I don't have the doc ID for you yet, but I will have it for you when I come back up here, showed that his monthly expenses were $6,116.18 at the time. His income had gone up from the time. He was then receiving, his retirement pay, absent that which he was sending to the respondent, the petitioner down below, and had secured work. He was also determined to be disabled by the Department of Veterans Affairs and was receiving disability compensation therefrom. He reported all of this income. When Judge Gower, sua sponte, recalculated the spousal maintenance factors, he should have taken into account the actual reported expenses of my client because he took into account the modification, the grant that he did for limiting her interest in his military retirement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. My name is Lena Holte. I represent Daniela Tate. She is the respondent in the appellate matter. I'm going to address her as respondent or wife, given the names are so close. You can refer to me as Ms. Holte. May it please the court, I will quickly address the issue that you guys talked with Mr. White on. It's my position that 5202 is very clear that you are able to take into consideration the totality of the case when he filed a 5202 motion. And McNulty does apply in this case because it's our position that the property was not distributed at that time. It wasn't complied with because my client had not received any of the property. At the hearing in December,
there isn't an agreement right now as to how this property is going to be divided from your perspective.
That's correct. He is correct that she did submit an email that said this is what she wanted, but at the hearing in December, it's all throughout the record, there was much disagreement as to how that property was going to get back to the country, who was going to pay for it. All the proposed solutions were objected to by the appellant as cost prohibitive. So it wasn't substantially complied with that time. There was no agreement. And
well, as to the assets themselves, is there a disagreement? Like, is the only disagreement over the shipping costs? Right, if we're talking about, I mean, if we're looking at the order in terms of the parties agreeing to divide the actual property, not how it's going to get back, but the actual property. Had the parties reached an agreement with regard to what property was going to go to who?
They had on that issue, but the agreement as a whole hadn't been executed, and there was a disagreement as to the practical nature of how that would be complied with. So
she didn't actually receive the property.
She had not received the property, no.
So now that the property's here in Minnesota, as it's not in the record, but is this issue really ripe at this point? Because there's a question about the trigger of this property division, and I'm wondering what your perspective is on that. If is this issue properly before us?
So my client lives in Georgia, so she still doesn't have the property. So there's still a question of how is she going to get it. So it's her position that she would still like it sold and divided and split in half, the proceeds split in half.
She has no objection to the modified order?
Correct.
And so the issue, from your perspective, is properly framed as whether the district court had the discretion to make this modification even without a party specifically asking for it.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, we're asking that you affirm that specific position, and we're actually asking you that you affirm the both orders in its totality.
Counsel, I have a question for you, a separate issue, and that is with respect to the future GI Bill funds that the district court had used to calculate husband's monthly income. Under case law, including the Carrick case, we look at the spousal maintenance obligation according to the party's income at the time of trial. But at the time of trial, he didn't have income from the GI Bill, did he?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay, so that should not be included in the spousal maintenance calculation, should it?
No, it should not.
Okay.
So it's our position. We did not raise that on appeal, so I don't believe that's before the court.
Well, you didn't raise it, but I believe appellant husband raised that issue.
That is correct. So we didn't object to that, though. No.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the candor, counsel.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to the income argument that your counterpart made with regard to the calculation of the appellant's income, then setting aside the GI Bill question?
So it's our position. So it's my understanding that he was asking to use method 3 under 518A32 to impute at 30 hours a week with a minimum wage. We would be asking that he use his actual income at the time of trial. And that is based on the Carrick case, which is followed up by the Bates case, which does specifically say you're not allowed to use speculative income. That's longstanding precedent. And we don't believe that the appellant has met the clearly erroneous burden that he would need to overturn that.
And did you wish to respond to the argument about using federal minimum wage versus Minnesota minimum wage?
On the minimum wage issue, with regard to my client specifically, she does live in Georgia. Method 1 was used by the district court to calculate her income. That is probable earnings level based on employment potential, recent work history, occupational qualifications, and the earnings level in that particular community. Precedent is also very clear from this court in Kuczynski versus Kuczynski, which says that you need to use the community in which the parent lives. Kuczynski, that was Kentucky. There's a follow-up case, Ramsey County versus EBS, that they used Oklahoma for that particular case.
Is it clear, though, that the district court used method one? Or I think there's, I mean, maybe you can point me to in the order where you see that the court clearly cited.
So they didn't specifically state that they used method one, but I believe it's clear on page 2, it would be Doc ID 59, page 3, they go through the analysis of the 18-year marriage. They're talking about Historically, she's had very sporadic work history. She's never worked full-time. She's never had a job. They spent 17 years together. Whether she has any educational skills and experience. I believe that fits the qualifications of Method 1. They don't do an analysis specifically under Method 3, so I think we can interpret the court's order that they are specifically using Method 1.
Was there a dispute down below as to what method should be used?
I can't speak to that. I wasn't. Okay. She was pro se, so I don't know. I believe that that's also part of the issue. So as far as going back to her actually ability to work, that was an issue in appellant's brief. The standard for that is 518A32 subdivision 3, subdivision 3, spousal maintenance uses child support statutes, and whether a party is voluntarily unemployed or underemployed, and specifically whether she's physically or mentally incapacitated and on her ability to be unemployed. And under that page 3 in the court's judgment and decree, the findings of fact are clear. They list out her health issues. They specifically list, you know, that she's got fibromyalgia, she's got a traumatic brain injury. They go through and make specific findings. They further go through specific findings that it was a lengthy marriage. The record is clear. The appellant himself testified that she had never worked full-time their entire marriage. He also testified that she had very sporadic work history. So I believe she meets the qualifications under method that she's voluntarily underemployed. So when you go back to the imputation of income, method 3 is also inappropriate because that requires her to work 30 hours a week. The judgment and decree specifically says she's only able to work 15 to 20 hours, so it's illogical that the court would require her under method 3 to work at least 30 hours or full time when they made the specific findings that she's only able to work 15 to 20. Let's see. Did you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
All right, I will defer.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I'm going to address the differences between Method 1 and Method 3 that was just
before. Could you first, do you know the answer to my question about whether it was raised down below?
I don't remember,
the appropriate Honor. Method of calculating it, because it seems to me if we're going to attribute an error to the district court, it would be good to know whether or not the district court was actually presented with this question of what method it should be applying.
I don't remember if it was specifically raised down below.
Did you have any citation? I noticed in your brief you urged pretty strongly that the district court would have been obligated to apply method 3, but as I understand it, the determination of potential income is a discretionary matter, and which method is left to the district court's discretion. So are you aware of any law that under these circumstances requires the application of method 3 versus method 1?
I have long posited, Your Honors, that a policy argument is the last refuge of a losing argument. But here I am going to make a policy argument. The policy argument is this. Her inability to work was based solely on her testimony. And if we base inability to work for medical reasons, which is what she claimed it was down below, and the court alluded to it in its order, the district court, when it says the court accordingly finds that the evidence discloses that wife most likely has the ability to only work on a limited part-time basis and then went into her testimony that related to all of the conditions she claimed to suffer from and had no documentation or testimonial evidence from an expert, a medical opinion, to support that, then what we end up having is we have a situation where a spouse who hasn't worked for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all decides that what they're going to do is they're just not going to work, and then they're going to come into this court or into a district court and say, because I haven't worked, you cannot say that I have to work.
But aren't you fundamentally challenging the discretion of the district court to make a credibility determination? I mean, wouldn't we be creating some special rule of evidence here requiring there to be documentary exhibits underlying a medical claim in this case and others? I mean, the district court had the discretion to say, I've received this testimony, I find it credible. And so why wouldn't you be asking us to change that or make a special rule for this particular case?
I'm asking you to take a look at the plain meaning of the statute and to state that in order to not presumptively be able to work at least 30 hours a week, that you have a situation where you have to do more than lay testimony. Yes.
The statute's language doesn't require documentary evidence.
No, it requires in other cases a medical condition, and the basis for her claim of her inability to work more than 15 to 20 hours a week was that she suffered from these medical conditions, evidence that was not admitted into the record. And because the parties lived apart for a very long time throughout the course of their marriage, the only testimony that could attest to any of that was the respondent, the petitioner down below, to state that. What ends up happening here is we could create, by stating that but lay testimony from an advocate, from a proponent themselves, of a medical inability to work could open the doors for a very, very large number of people who are claiming an inability to work for medical conditions that are not supported by any...
But isn't she really providing lay testimony that she's been diagnosed with particular conditions?
That is exactly what she did, Your Honor. You're right about that.
But isn't she allowed... I mean, don't we allow lay people to testify as to the facts that they know, and the district court can decide whether to believe that person or not believe that person?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, and my time is almost ended, but I'd like to finish.
Please.
Yes, to the condition, but not to the incapacity that's resulting from the condition. You should require more than that in order to do that. I myself would welcome, as a litigator in family law, would welcome that decision from the court, because let's face it, it's going to create a lot of nice new cases for me and other family law attorneys. The court doesn't have anything else. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, both for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted. We'll issue a decision in the statute.